This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Ed Yong is a science writer at The Atlantic. His work has appeared in Wired, The New York Times, The New Yorker, Nature, The Guardian, Discover, and many more. And he has won a lot of awards for his writing. A lot of awards. There isn't time to read them all. But he has been awarded the Byron H. Waxman Award for Excellence in the Public Communication of Life Sciences, the Michael E. DeBakey Journalism Award, and the European Science Writers Junior Award. And those are just in 2016. And perhaps Ed has won these awards because he takes the unusual approach of writing things that are full of research and information but are also somehow fun to read. His blog, Not Exactly Rocket Science, is a very good example of this. And this book tonight, I Contain Multitudes, is also a very good example. So please welcome Ed Wong.
All right, so thank you everyone for coming tonight, especially to all the people standing out back. I hope this will be fun for you. I'm going to talk for about half an hour. And then we'll go over to questions and to the signing. This is, in fact, the first time I am doing this talk, so Lord help us all. Okay, so I'm going to start by taking you back in time by about 350 years. So the year is 1675, and the place is Delft in the Netherlands. And a man called Antony van Leeuwenhoek is about to change the world. This man is not a scientist. He's not a scholar of any description. He is a draper and a civic servant. But he has two really important qualities. He has an insatiable curiosity about the world, and he is the owner of the world's most powerful microscopes. Rather, he's the maker of the world's most powerful microscopes. He creates them himself, grinding impossibly perfect spherical lenses, sandwiching them between brass plates to create an object that looks a little bit like a glorified door hinge, but that somehow magnifies objects 10 times better than anything else around. And Leeuwenhoek turns them onto everything else around, onto bits of animals, of plants, and of water. Water that collects in a pot outside his house, water from canals and from lakes near Delft. And everywhere he looks, he sees tiny organisms, alive, moving, and in enormous numbers. They are bacteria, microbes. And Leeuwenhoek has just become the first person in the history of the entire world to see them with his own eyes. And what a glorious moment that must have been. He realizes that below the level of our perception, life exists in untold quantities. And he realizes the same is true for his own body, because he scrapes dental plaque from his teeth and he looks at that through those same microscopes. And again, he sees multitudes. Was he disgusted by this? Was he repulsed? No, he was actually enchanted. He was excited to learn that there were more things living in his mouth than there were people in the entirety of the Netherlands. Because it took a long time for microbes to gain the cultural baggage that we have glommed onto them, for them to become associated with disease, with dirt, to become cast as villains, as things to be eradicated. And that only happened because we realized that in quick succession, many of the most infamous of diseases, plague, syphilis, gonorrhea, cholera, typhoid, these were all caused by microbes. And so they forever became billed as villains, as things that we needed to remove from our lives and destroy, lest they destroy us. But that perception is deeply wrong, because only a small minority of microbes cause us harm. Only a few hundred kinds or so are causes of disease. The rest are benign or beneficial to us. And in fact, they are the lords of the planet, and they always have been. So if you look at these bookshelves here, if we assume that these shelves represent the entirety of life on Earth, so that the Earth was created here, and this is the present moment here, then humans arose here, and the dinosaurs were around kind of from where this bit's sticking out to there. Multicellular life, so everything you can see with your eyes, every animal and plant arose probably about here. So for the majority of life's history, from here all the way back to when it first arose here, life was entirely microbial. You would never have been able to see it with your naked eyes, which would be fine because eyes evolved here. So, we are but the icing on a vast microbial cake. And we animals live, evolved in a bacterial world. We were, right from our first moments, we were surrounded by them and filled by them. And we plugged ourselves into their biology. We came to live with them, to exploit them, and to crucially depend upon them. Because what other choice did we have? Every animal living today, every hummingbird and hawk, every elephant, every ant, is a teeming collection of other organisms in and on its body. So a human, for example, me standing up here seemingly alone, I am home to about 39 trillion bacterial cells, roughly one for each of my own human cells. So I am at most half the person who I think I am. The same is true for everything else. A sponge is the same thing you make your bath sponges from. It's among the simplest of animals. Its body is just a couple of cell layers sandwiching some jelly. But it, too, is home to a teeming microbiome, a collection of microbes. An ant colony can number in its millions, but every single ant is a colony in itself. A polar bear walking through the Arctic with nothing but ice in all directions is, in fact, completely surrounded. Bar-headed geese fly microbes over the tops of the Himalayas. Sperm whales dive them down to the bottom of the oceans. And when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin set foot on the moon, they were also taking giant steps for microbe kind. These microbes are not just stowaways. They're not hitchhikers on our bodies. They are vital parts of our lives. And in some creatures, they bestow their hosts with extraordinary abilities. So I got to meet a creature called the bobtail squid while writing this book. It's an adorable animal that would fit on the palm. And it has luminous bacteria in its bodies that shine light below the squid that perfectly matches the moonlight shining from above, so that any predator looking from below will be unable to see the squid's silhouette. The bacteria make it invisible. There are worms that kill insects by vomiting toxic microbes into their bodies. There's a bird called a hoopoe, which protects its chicks from disease by painting its eggs with antibiotic-producing microbes. Their hyenas can write their autobiographies in scents produced by microbes on their bodies. They rub pastes made by those bacteria onto grass stems, and the smells of those pastes reflect their age, their sex, their social status, their species. And we humans, too, rely on the microbes that we carry around with us. They help to protect us from disease, counterintuitively. They help to digest our food. They help to train our immune systems. They might even influence our behavior. I've been writing about this area of science for about 10 years or so. And there are a few topics in biology that interest me more. Because all my life I have loved the natural world. I have been to zoos. I watched David Attenborough documentaries. I read natural history books. But learning about the science of the microbiome has shown me that every time I go to a zoo, every visitor and resident there is a zoo in its own right. And that the lives of all these creatures that we are familiar with and that we can see with our eyes is profoundly influenced by organisms that we cannot see. And I think that's a startling and wondrous view of the world. And it's why I wrote I Contain Multitudes, to open our eyes to this grander view of life. Because when we look at the world around us through this microbial lens, even the most familiar aspects of our lives become newly wondrous and amazing. So consider breastfeeding. Breastfeeding seems like a way of nourishing a baby. But in fact, something like 10% of breast milk consists of these sugars that babies cannot digest. They are there to nourish the baby's first microbes, and specifically strains and species that have evolved to digest those sugars and to break them down with incredible efficiency. And in return, those microbes feed a baby's gut cells, and they shore up the lining of the gut, and they turn down inflammation in the baby's body. So a breastfeeding mother isn't just nourishing her child. She is also building an ecosystem in its body. She is setting up this entire world. And that world, in turn, sets us up. Because every animal develops from a single fertilized egg into a body full of trillions of cells. And that path, that process of development, doesn't happen under our own steam. It doesn't just unfold. It happens in conversation with the microbes that live with us. So some animals cannot reach adulthood without encountering the right microbes. In the oceans, there are tiny worms that create tubes in which they live that are only about that big, but they can get so thick that they can clog the propellers of ships. And these worms only make the tubes if they become adults. They only make the adults if they encounter the right microbes in the environment. If all the bacteria in the world suddenly died, these creatures would be unable to complete their life cycle and be forever stuck as kids like Peter Pan. Other animals that we're more familiar with, fish, humans, rats, we also rely on microbes to shape and sculpt our bodies. And you can see the influence of these tiny partners most when you look at animals that don't have them. So in labs around the world, scientists have raised sterile animals, fish, mice, the like. They live their entire lives in these plastic bubbles, disconnected from the microbial world, eating sterile food, drinking sterile water. They are among the strangest creatures in the world because they do not contain multitudes. They are like silhouettes that haven't been filled in. And because of that, because they don't have a microbiome of their own, they have all kinds of problems. Their guts, bones, blood vessels, possibly their brains, they don't develop correctly. A testament to how important microbes can be in shaping and sculpting ourselves. Their immune systems are out of whack too. And that's weird, right? Because we think of the immune system in terms of these militaristic metaphors as something that finds and destroys anything that isn't part of ourselves. And yet, scientists have shown that microbes actually stimulate the development of certain types of immune cells. And they calibrate the immune system so that it can react to infectious threats, but it doesn't overreact to things in the world around us, harmless things like dust or pollen and the like. So microbes actually build and tune the immune system. And the immune system, in turn, doesn't destroy all microbes. It tolerates the ones that live in our bodies. It actually selects for them, deciding which species get to live with us and which do not. So I think of it more as a team of rangers who might care for a national park that are trying to decide which species get to stay there, to manage their population levels, to chuck out invaders. And the twist here, of course, is that it's the residents of the park that hired and trained the rangers in the first place. So health, immunity, digestion, development, thought perhaps, all of these aspects of our lives that we think of as the province of individuals are in fact built and influenced by partnerships. We are built in collaboration with the organisms that share our lives and our bodies. And those collaborations matter very much for individuals, for us in our lifespans, but they also matter over much longer evolutionary timescales. Many animals, many groups of animals, owe their extraordinary success to the microbes that they carry. Time and again, bacteria and other microbes have allowed animals to overcome their basic animalness, to succeed at lifestyles that would otherwise have been denied to them. A good example of these are the sap-sucking insects, the bugs or hemipterans, aphids, leafhoppers, cicadas, the ones that are the bane of farmers and gardeners around the world. They can only survive because they have bacteria in their bodies that provide them with nutrients that are missing from their meals, that act as dietary supplements. And without those microbes, those insects would not be able to eat the food that they eat, would not be able to monopolize that source of food that only they can really properly exploit. And that's why there are some 85,000 species of them. And in the deep oceans, there are other animals that have taken this concept of supplement, nutrient supplementation, to an even greater extreme. There's a worm that's like grows up to 2 meters long. It is huge. It creates a tube for itself again and has these red gills that look like a tube of lipstick that's been pushed way out. And its body is full of microbes that provide it with all the nutrients that it needs. In this place where there is no food, the bacteria grab minerals from around the water and provide nutrients to the worm, which has lost its mouth and its gut. Because why bother eating when you have microbes to provide you with all the energy that you need? Of course, most animals have kept their guts, including some very familiar ones like cows, sheep, guts, ourselves. And those grazing mammals have turned their guts into giant fermenters, into vast accommodation for the microbes that they carry. And for good reason, too, because those microbes provide them with something like 70% of their energy. Again, if they were to disappear, our farms would be barren. The plains of Africa would be empty. So, microbes have provided animals with incredible evolutionary opportunities. They have also massively accelerated the pace of animal evolution from time to time. Because if an animal wants to adapt to challenges in an environment, it can accumulate gradual changes in its genome in a very slow Darwinian way. Or it can recruit microbes that already know how to meet those challenges. So rather than, say they're a company, rather than training their existing staff to perform new skills, they can just hire new recruits who already have those skills. And you see loads of examples of this around the world. In Japan, there's an insect that can become instantly resistant to insecticides if it swallows the right detoxifying microbes in the soil. And this applies to us humans as well. And one of my favorite microbiome stories involves sushi, sort of. So for centuries, Japanese people have been harvesting seaweed from the oceans, which they've used to make nori, which is the same stuff that wraps sushi nowadays. And they used to eat the stuff raw, so they swallowed marine microbes that lived on the seaweed and that were capable of breaking down the unique blend of carbohydrates within it. When those marine microbes entered their gut, they mingled with gut microbes. And they did something that bacteria do all the time, and that is astonishing to us. They swapped their genes. So you and I can only pass our genes down from parent to child. But microbes can swap genes all the time, as easily as I will give some of you autographs later on. And so these marine microbes lent their seaweed digesting genes to the gut microbes of those people of old, which is why to this day the gut microbiomes in Japanese people are exceptionally good at breaking down the carbohydrates found in sushi. Okay, so microbes are important, microbes are cool. I'm going to belabor the point. Well, one thing that's really important to note is something microbes are not, which is they are not our friends. So the old narrative that all microbes are germs, are agents of disease, is being replaced by this talk of friendly bacteria and good microbes. And that, to me, is just as wrong, because they are neither our friends or our enemies. Those that live in our gut, for example, help us to digest our food. But if they cross the lining of the gut, which they are prone to do given the chance, they can cause inflammation or sepsis. There's really no such thing as a good microbe or a bad microbe. And these terms belong in children's stories. They're ill-suited for describing this messy contextual relationships that are found in the natural world. Many things in our lives can actually change our microbiomes in very negative ways, transforming them into communities that are worse for us. You see this with a lot of human conditions. Many, many diseases and disorders, a huge laundry list of them, so long as to invite parody, really, have been linked to changes in the gut microbiome. Obesity, diabetes, type 1 and type 2, allergies, asthma, colorectal cancer, heart disease, the list goes on. Trump. Wait. I didn't. We're not filming this, are we? Now, in most of these cases, it is unclear if the changes in the microbiome are leading to the disorder, or if they're a consequence of, or if it's both, or if it's neither. There are, however, many studies which suggest that the microbes have a sort of causal influence involving those germ-free rodents that I told you about. You can do experiments where you can take a person or an animal that has some kind of disorder, take the microbes in their body and put them into a germ-free rodent, and you will see that many of the symptoms of their condition transfer too. So if you put the microbes from a malnourished child, for example, into one of these sterile mice, the mouse will lose weight if it also eats a poor diet. If you take the microbes from an individual with atherosclerosis, then the rodent will pack up fatty deposits in its arteries. So these studies suggest that the microbes aren't just going along for the ride. To an extent, they are also grabbing the wheel. How big is that extent? That is something that scientists are looking at right now. And they're also looking to understand what is it about our lives that changes the microbiome in the first place. And there are many possible reasons. We in the West live in concrete cities rather than muddy farms. We have lost contact with microbes and animals and in soils. We sanitize everything with antibacterial whatever. When I was reporting for this book, I was staying in a hotel room and picked up a phone and it said antibacterial handset. I don't even know how you make a handset antibacterial, but there you go. We take large doses of antibiotics, drugs that have done a tremendous amount for us. They've been an incredible health good, and yet they also harm the bacteria that we depend upon as well as those that cause us harm. We eat a diet that is relatively low in fruits and vegetables and fiber. And fiber, because it contains this vast range of carbohydrates that nourishes a vast range of bacteria, the loss of that fiber means that we have winnowed the communities that live with us. So what can we do about that? Well, theoretically, quite a lot. It should be possible to influence the microbiome in deliberate ways. After all, it can change in positive and negative ways. Surely it can change in ways that we also choose. But actually, in practice, doing this is very difficult. So probiotics, for example, these products, these drink sachets and pills and whatnot that supposedly contain beneficial bacteria, end up being actually quite medically underwhelming. They're quite good for some things like infectious diarrhea, but their benefits are vastly oversold compared to the claim that if you look at the claims, the health claims that have surrounded them, they often don't live up to those claims. And that's because they can often be heavily industrialized strains, so kind of like domesticated microbes that are present in very small quantities and that aren't very well suited to life in the gut. So maybe instead of these products, we should be considering taking large communities of microbes that are well suited for life in the gut. And that is the logic behind an unorthodox and slightly grim procedure called the fecal transplant, which is exactly what it sounds like. It is a way of transplanting the microbiome from a healthy donor into a sick recipient, an attempt to reset their faltering ecosystem by completely replacing it, like re-turfing a lawn that's been overrun with dandelions. And in this case, the dandelions are one particular very weedy, very invasive species of bacterium called Clostridium difficile, or C. diff, which causes severe recurring cases of diarrhea, and that can be fatal. C. diff, fecal transplants are basically the best option we have for treating it now, based on what we know. There was a very famous Dutch trial in which standard antibiotics treated something like 27% of patients with C. diff, whereas fecal transplants cured something like 94%. So we're in a weird situation where the number one treatment for this condition is a number two. I don't know more where that came from. But despite those successes with C. diff have led people to try fecal transplants with a lot of other conditions. And their success has been less pronounced and certainly more inconsistent. Because C. diff might represent a very unusual case. It's a case where people have been taking antibiotics for a very long time, and they take antibiotics once they get the condition too, which means that they have killed a lot of their native gut companions and created an ecosystem that is perhaps very easy for a donor's community to reset. And maybe that is much harder for something like inflammatory bowel disease or irritable bowel syndrome or many of the other conditions that the microbiome has been linked to. Because this is an act of re-engineering an entire ecosystem. It's like trying to change a coral reef or a grassland or a rainforest with all the complexity that that entails. It's not just a case of saying, this bacterium does a good thing in a laboratory study, we'll give it to people, and boom, we're off to the races. It's more complicated than that. And we are still at the very beginnings of this journey. We are still at the start of understanding how the microbiome works, which species live within us. We don't even have a complete roll call. What factors influence why my microbiome differs to yours or yours or yours? We largely don't know, let alone working out how best to manipulate these worlds. But the potential for doing so is really great. There is huge promise, and how long it will take to realize that promise is unclear, but it will take a lot of basic work. And so to finish off, I'm just going to tell you one last story that I think best exemplifies a lot of the themes in the book and is an example where the exploration of the microbial world has led to incredible benefits or could potentially do so. So it starts in 1924 with two scientists called Hertig and Wolbach. And they look inside a mosquito, a common brown mosquito, somewhere I think in Boston. And they find this new microbe that they've never seen before and that no one else has seen before. And they think nothing of it. It doesn't seem to be important, common, anything. It takes 12 years for Hertig to name it, and he names it after his friend, and he calls it Wolbachia. Decades later, many scientists who are studying bacteria in insects suddenly realize that they've all been studying the same thing, which is Wolbachia. This thing is everywhere. It is in something like 4 out of every 10 species of insects and other arthropods, which are themselves the most numerous and diverse animals on the planet. So this little bug, this innocuous thing, has good claim to being one of the most successful microbes on land. What it does varies from host to host. So in some insects, Wolbachia is a master manipulator, and it has a thing out for males because it only passes down from mothers to daughters down the female line. So if it gets into a male, it has many ways of solving that problem. In some cases, it transforms the males into females, and other times it kills the males outright so that the adult population has something like 100 females to every one male. In some insects, it allows the females to reproduce asexually, so they can clone themselves without any need for males whatsoever. That doesn't sound too bad, really. And in many cases, though, Wolbachia is a mutualist, an ally. It provides nutrients to bedbugs. It allows some caterpillars that eat leaves to stop leaves from yellowing. It literally holds back the progress of fall to allow its hosts to eat for longer. And it has properties that are of great interest to us. So for the last 25 years, Australian scientists have been trying to implant Wolbachia into one species of insect that doesn't naturally carry it. The tiger mosquito, Aedes aegypti, the cause of dengue fever, of Zika, of yellow fever, and so on. And the reason they're doing that is because when Wolbachia gets into those mosquitoes, it stops them from spreading the viruses behind those diseases. And Wolbachia is also incredibly good at spreading through wild population because it manipulates the biology of its host so well. So if you release a small number of these infected mosquitoes into the wild, suddenly Wolbachia should be everywhere. And suddenly the entire wild population of mosquitoes, without a single insect life being lost, ought to be able to be unable to transmit these infections which matter to us. They've tried this in Australia in a couple of suburbs. In just a few months, the proportion of Wolbachia in local mosquitoes went from nothing to almost completely dominant. And that group is now testing these insects in countries around the world, in large megacities in Brazil and Colombia, Indonesia and Vietnam. And this approach has many advantages. Nothing is genetically modified. These microbes are not altered at all. They are just being united with an animal host that they do not naturally live in. The approach is safe. It is not toxic like insecticides. And unlike insecticides, which need to be resprayed all the time, once you let these mosquitoes go, they are self-sustaining. Could Hertig and Wolbach have dreamt of any of this when they first discovered that microbe? No, of course they couldn't. They had no idea what they'd found. In fact, Wolbach died before anyone knew that Wolbachia was actually common, before people realized that his name had been grafted onto one of the greatest pandemics in the history of life. And the story of Wolbachia to me is the story of animal microbiomes in a nutshell. For the longest time, we have neglected these things. We have feared them. And only recently have we started to appreciate them. Only recently have we gained enough confidence to start to try and manipulate them to improve our lives. Only recently have we understood what a profound influence they have upon us. And all of that begins with basic curiosity, with a desire to learn more about the world around us and the things that we share it with. And I hope that people who read the book will have that same curiosity stoked within them, that they will want to learn more about us and our place in the world. Thank you for listening.
About 20 minutes for questions. We'll get to as many as we can, and just please make your way to the microphone as people already are. Thank you.
Hello. Could you comment on the treatment of obesity through this, and also diabetes? If I know that those are big topics, but if you, especially obesity.
Sure. I think that's it's the thing everyone wants, right? I think everyone wants a solution to our health ills, and certainly when the links between obesity and the microbiome were first discovered, newspaper headlines were full of things like, oh, you know, we'll swallow the right bacteria and we'll suddenly become thin. And it turns out to be more complicated than that, because we know that microbes can affect the way we process nutrients. They can influence our body weight, either both obesity and malnutrition. But it's still unclear which microbes are linked to both of these extremes, which species have been linked to either weight gain or weight loss. And in one critical experiment, and this is a very rough take on it, but essentially mice lost weight if they took the right microbes, but only if they also ate a healthy diet too. So there's no shortcuts. There's no microbial panacea that's going to fix the ills of the 21st century. It's, you know, healthy diet, all those things will still be important. But perhaps the microbes within us will provide a way of at least stacking the odds in our favor. But again, this is something that's, you know, this link has been researched for about 10 years now. It's one of the most long-standing areas of research in microbiome and the human health. And we still have more questions than we have answers.
It's my turn. Okay. Among the influences or possible effects that you mentioned that our personal biome may have on us, the long list, and apparently the one that's the least well established, I gathered from your comments, is effect on thought or emotions. I guess it's a sort of a two-part question. How well established is that, or mm-hmm. And what might the mechanism be for having an effect on, is it through hormones or?
Yeah, those are great questions. And they're both sort of related. So there have been a lot of animal studies showing that microbes can influence behavior, that they can influence things like resilience to stress, susceptibility to anxiety, even mood, aspects of personality. Of course, mice are not people, and it's very difficult to interpret the results of animal experiments, especially when it relates to social things like behavior. And there are a lot of inconsistencies in those studies. So sometimes you'll see a reduction in anxiety, sometimes you'll see an increase. But, you know, I think it's pretty safe to say that there is some influence on our behavior. And that seems to make sense. It feels intuitive and plausible to me, given all the other aspects of our biology that microbes are associated with. But the degree to which they, you know, how strong is that effect? We're not sure. How relevant is it to us in our daily lives? Again, it's a little unclear. But there's a lot of work going in this area. It's a very, very hot space. So expect more in the coming years. As to mechanism, there are a lot, and this is one of the big questions that people in the field are asking. So how would this work? There is a nerve, the vagus nerve, which connects the brain to the gut that could transmit signals. The immune system could act as a conduit. Bacteria in the gut produce neurotransmitters. They produce things like serotonin and dopamine that we typically think of as brain signaling chemicals. So any and all of these routes could be important, and each of them have been shown to be important in different studies. So again, like how does the big picture look? And I think that's something that we're still trying to figure out. Thank you. Anyone else? Hi. Wait. So it's okay. So the question was, should we sequence our microbiomes? So I did not when reporting the book, mainly because I don't think we're at a stage with the science where it can really tell us anything useful. I think I could do that. But there are still even like technical discussions in the field, you know, how you well, like whether the results you get from such products are going to be reliable, and then actually interpreting them. It feels to me like getting a horoscope, right? You know, you could read all sorts of things into what comes out, but whether it actually gives you practical, useful things, I'm not really convinced. So I feel like the best reason to do that is to contribute to science. So if you care about science, if you want to take part in experiments, if you want to give the researchers who are featured in this book something more to study, like an extra an N plus one for their study, then yeah, by all means go ahead. But don't do it expecting to like have the secrets of your body unlocked before you.
Hey, so I know that it's known that antibiotics certainly affect the microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious if something like a proton pump inhibitor, which will shut off the stomach acid, or if any non-antibiotic medications are known to affect the microbiome in any other way.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the drugs we take do seem to affect the microbiome. A lot of them do. So I can't remember exactly if proton pump inhibitors do. I know like antihistamines. So a lot of different groups do. What that means in the long term, again, you know, there are more questions than answers here. Like the if we think of the microbiome as like any environment, so like a rainforest or a grassland, if you ding any system like that, it will bounce back because there's a certain thing. They have a certain resilience. So antibiotics will change the microbes within us, but certainly there have been a lot of studies suggesting that in the long term there is recovery. So there is, you know, those worlds go back to an earlier state. So how many dings you need to change it permanently, what the effects are of those changes in the long term, again, are open questions. The one really interesting thing about the microbiome, which I didn't really get to cover in the talk, is and that is in the book, is that they affect the way we respond to our drugs. So drugs may affect them, but it's also the reverse is also true. Everything from paracetamol, I think you guys call it acetaminophen.
Yeah.
Um, that to like the hottest new cancer immunotherapies. They work in some people and they don't in others. And the microbiome could be one reason behind that variation. So while I said that like adding microbes to a person's body might be still a difficult thing for a long time, it might be we might be able to exploit the microbiome by looking by trying to work out which people will do best with which medications.
Thank you. Question about the book. How do you go from seeing microbiology and saying, wow, microbes are so cool, to deciding that, you know, you want to try and fit this vast topic into a book?
It in a surprisingly short and unexpected amount of time. So in January of 2014, I remember sending an email to the man who is now my editor saying, please stop pestering me for book proposals. I'm not going to write a book. Don't want to write a book. Please stop. And then about, I think 2 weeks later, I sent him a subsequent email saying, here is my book proposal. Please disregard earlier email. I think someone hacked my computer. Maybe I was drunk. I don't know. So it just, you know, I've been reporting this for a long time, and I think the idea of turning this into a book came quite quickly. And I think you'll have gathered from the talk today that I Contain Multitudes covers things like health and diet, but it is predominantly, I think, a natural history book. And that idea was one of the driving forces behind it. And that sort of sprung out of my head, like fully formed, in a very short amount of time.
Hi, a two-part question. The first is, do you think that these insights, these evolving insights, are going to lead in the near future to some refined definition of what a healthy diet is?
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you were an employee of a large company that sells processed food, mm-hmm. would you be kind of nervous about all this stuff that's emerging?
Okay, so will it lead to new insights or into diet? Maybe, but what I want to note is that there is no single healthy microbiome that applies to everyone, that everyone should be aiming for, and thus no single way of telling people what to hit. The microbiome is such a dynamic entity. It depends on everything that we experience in our day-to-day lives, and I just don't think that we're going to reach a point where we get universal dietary recommendations that you should stick to for the microbiome, or at least nothing in the kind of detail that I think people expect. You know, one of the aspects of the diet and the microbiome that I think is strongest is the idea that dietary fiber is important, right? For as I said, it nourishes a wide range of microbes in our bodies. But we've been told to eat lots of fiber for a very long time. That hasn't changed because of the science of the microbiome. It has just been at most reinforced. And I feel the same thing about your processed food question. You know, would I be nervous about the science that's coming here? You know, I feel that there's been a lot of research about processed food and its role in our health through just human epidemiology, through just studying the human half of ourselves. You know, this may reinforce it. Is it going to radically alter what we know? I'm not sure.
Hi. So kind of related to the question, the man who was standing here before me. So when you're writing and it's such a rapidly evolving field, was there ever a moment where you're like, oh, something has just come up and I have to go back and write all these chapters again? And then related to that, what happens when, you know, the research isn't there yet? Yeah. And it hasn't caught up yet.
Yeah, these are really good questions. So I did actually ask all the scientists who I interviewed to stop publishing for about 6 months. But none of them did it. I mean, it's so ungrateful. Everything I've done for them, I can't believe it. They kept on publishing. I feel like, you know, I tried with this. I try to go for stories that are long-lasting, that have been built over years. I try to go for themes that are not going to change, that microbes influence animal development, that they shape our evolutionary opportunities. All of these things, you know, they're not going to be different 5 years from now, 6 years from now. So I'm confident in how the book will stand the test of time. I think details may change, but actually I think that I tried specifically to go for stories that illustrate these broader enduring themes. You know, unless some study comes out tomorrow telling me that microbes are in fact not important and are minor parts of the world around us and don't influence our lives, I would be really surprised by that. You know, I feel that I've tried to make the book change-proof in that way. But of course things will change. And yeah, things were, you know, new stuff came out that during the time I was editing and in the last few months I wish I could have included. I think so far none of the studies that I've written about have been retracted yet. And there's actually some unpublished work in there too. So it's sort of looking forward a little bit too.
I'm afraid I have a very silly question.
Yes.
In writing this book, did you happen to develop an inordinate fondness for one particular microbe or, system?
Yes. So Wolbachia is my favorite. It has always been my favorite, because it's so varied. It's so different in what it does. It just has so many stories to tell, and it features a lot in the book in like various chapters. Anything else? Not sure. So the milk story is one of my favorites too. So that link between Bifidobacterium longum infantis or B. infantis and milk is one of my favorite stories. Those two are the ones that I've told most often in the radio interviews. If anyone is playing the I Contain Multitudes publicity drinking game right now, one shot each. I'm not even joking. I did make a drinking game.
Okay. Ed, thank you. This has been fantastic.
Thank you.
So related to the earlier diet question, maybe not universal dietary guidelines can be informed by the microbiome, but what do you forecast the future of personalized nutrition to be?
Yeah, that is a really interesting question. So I feel I want to skirt the question a little bit by focusing on the personalized bit rather than the nutrition side. But like, I do think that the microbiome is so individual. It accounts for a lot of the variations between us. And I think by understanding that variation, we might be able to better personalize the way we look at our health. So there's a going back to the earlier question about speculative stuff, you know, I tried to give a very sober view of where the science is now. But there's a bit in the book where I clearly just launch like 30 years into the future and say, hey, this is what it might look like. So you might go to a doctor and they might prescribe you, microbes that reduce inflammation because you have markers in your body that show that. They might look at your genome and find that you have an inherited risk of inflammatory bowel disease and give you microbes that are meant to deal with that. So you might get this cocktail of like personalized prescribed microbes that are tailored to your specific body. The native community that you already have in your gut, your genome, maybe you'll get a dietary plan that is meant to nourish those specific microbes, just like the sugars in breast milk nourish B. infantis. Will we get there anytime soon? I don't know. I like to joke, and this is in the book, that scientists always claim that it'll take 5 years for their discoveries to be translated into practical applications. So let's say 5 years, and you can get back to 2021. All right, two more questions.
Hi. So you alluded to this before, but you talked about how there are so many different stories that possibly you weren't able to include in your book. Is there one story that you wish had made the book, or perhaps a story with a scientist or a memory from when you were researching the content for this book?
Oh, that's a nice question. So I briefly alluded to this. So there are those worms that kill insects by vomiting toxic bacteria into their bodies. Those bacteria kill the insects because they produce like toxic molecules. Those same molecules can also counter infections. And those microbes also happen to glow in the dark. So in the U.S. Civil War, troops would often find that their wounds were giving off this bizarre glow. And whenever the glow happened, they wouldn't get infections. And that seems to be because of these luminous bacteria. And the glow was called the angel's glow. So from vomiting toxic bacteria to angel's glow protecting soldiers, I think that just perfectly shows what I said earlier about how there are no good and bad microbes. It's all contextual. Hi. Last question.
Has our study of the microbiomes influenced our ability to grow these bacteria in the lab? Because that is a big problem nowadays, that we see all these sequences, but we don't actually have the ability to phenotypically analyze them. And I mean, if you go to the zoo example, we can see them in the wild, but we can't take them into captivity.
Yeah, that's right.
And so it's like the study of the microbiomes have like influenced our ability to like grow them in communities, that type of thing.
Yeah. So for anyone who did catch that, so it used to be that we only studied microbes by growing them in the lab. So growing them in like flasks and petri dishes. And it was actually the ability to take random swabs from the environment, so like this desk, my forehead, whatever, and then crack open all the microbes therein and sequence all their DNA and then identify them through that means. That was one of the key things that allowed the science of the microbiome to take off. But as our questioner just noted, it's kind of an odd way of studying microbes. It's, you know, it's like going to a zoo, and rather than actually looking at all the animals there, you just put everything in like a chipper and you just count all the parts that come out. This suddenly went dark, didn't it? I need a better metaphor for this question. So he was asking, are we actually then getting better at growing the microbes whose genes we analyze? And the answer is yeah. So it was a really interesting study that I think came out either this year or last year. This group took a lot of these unculturables and actually found ways of culturing them. It turns out you can brute force it. There are tricks you can use. And a lot of these, they suddenly had like access to this wide range of microbial diversity, a lot of which I think are these spore-forming species that can persist in the environment. They are feeding off each other, the genetics and the culturing, and I think that will hopefully give us a better understanding of how these communities work. Okay. Thank you. Thanks, folks.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to Ed.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.